Hey, good evening, everybody. It is wonderful to see everybody back. We have a new opportunity of learning because every few weeks we start a new series. This is a new series, and the topic is Eliyahu HaNavi. We've heard about him, we've sing about him, we learn about him, but it's really nice actually to be able to actually get a sense of where he comes from. And before jumping to all the Kabbalistic Midrashic ideas, let's see what the Tanakh tells us about him, because that's the starting place of everything important. So as we've been doing in the past, we usually take about 4 or 5 weeks per series. This series is going to be very similar size to the last one. We did 5 weeks on bridges and walls, where we focused on Prakim Yudalad, Tesvav, Teszayin in Sefer Melachim Aleph. Now we're going to be focusing on another three Prakim, and those are Yudzayin, Yudches, and Yudtes. So if you want to be following in the Sefer where it is that we're going, that's what we're doing. And this is going to take us through the major episodes of Eliyahu. It is not the full collection of Eliyahu, because there are a few small incidents that are going to occur later on as well involving Eliyahu. But this is the primary focus of the main events that Tanakh gives us. So let's start off together. If you did not get the sources, that is totally fine. I'm going to be sharing screen right over here, so we're going to be doing this together. Let's learn, let's learn, let's learn. We're going to start off with meeting Eliyahu HaNavi. When you think about Eliyahu HaNavi, think about the image that conjures up. Think in your mind what the image that conjures up. For some people, it's more perhaps more the more famous events in his life, which involve the fire coming down from heaven. That's a very famous event. We're going to study that next week or the week after. However, tonight, actually, rather than the image of fire, I think it's important to think about the image of water. So it's important to think about the control Eliyahu has over the elements in this world. And tonight, the focus is going to be the control of the element water. Next week will be the control over fire. Each one is unique and distinct. Let's start at the very beginning. In order to understand who Eliyahu is, we need to understand where he comes from. Before we start, I want to also start off by saying a special thank you to our members, to Ricky and Debbie Eisenberg, who are sponsoring, and to the Hirsch Mishpacha, who are sponsoring tonight's shir on the second yahrzeit of Mr. Leon Eisenberg, Hechaver Aryeh Ben Yaakov Olav Shalom. It is deeply meaningful to all of us who knew Mr. Eisenberg very well, who spent so much time in our shul, was a tremendous person, always a person of positivity, who brought so much, who brought calm, who brought consistency to the shul, and we miss him very, very much. I know that he used to be very proud of the fact that he was Hechaver Aryeh Ben Yaakov, really a true Yekka, and the Be'ezras Hashem, Yehi Zichro Baruch, may his memory always be a blessing. We remember him all very fondly and think about him, especially on his yahrzeit. I cannot believe that it's been 2 years already. Let's start off our learning together, Le'ilui Nishmasai. We're going to be looking, actually, before we even start Perek Yud Zayin, a little bit of a trick. We're going to go backwards into Perek Tes Zayin. We're going to look at the end of the 16th Perek, and that's important because in order to understand Eliyahu, we need to understand his counterparts. It's going to be interesting to witness this area in Tanakh where you have a protagonist and an antagonist. I'm going to leave open for a second who is the antagonist. Not so simple. Let's take a look. We start looking at the psukim over here. We're going to look, as we usually do, in groups of psukim rather than pasuk by pasuk. Then we're going to take a step backwards and think about how we can understand this. Here's what we're told. V'achav ben Omri, molach al Yisrael bishnas 38 shana. So we know that the son of Omri, we studied Omri last week, his son Achav takes the lead in the 38th year, the Asa Melech Yehuda, measured in the years of the king of Yehuda in the south. V'imroch Achav ben Omri al Yisrael v'shamram 22 shana. He had a nice, fruitful reign of 22 years. That's a very long period of time. He outlives his king in the south, Asa. Vayas Achav ben Omri hara b'nei Hashem mikol asher lefonov. He did worse than anybody before him. That seems to be the general trajectory. Unfortunately, we'll see why in just a moment. Vayhi anokel lechtoi b'hachatos Yerovam ben Nevat. It was a light thing for him to even do what his predecessor Yerovam ben Nevat did. Vayikach Yisho es Izevel bas et Baal melech Tzidonim vayelech vayavod es Habal vayishtachuloi. He married Izevel, Jezebel, who was the daughter of Et Baal, the king of Sidon, and he set up Baal worship and bowed down to him. Vayakom mizbeach leBaal beis haBaal asher bona b'Shomron. He established a full-blown shrine to Baal, and we hear further. Vayas Achav es Asherah, he made the Asherah, and Vayosef Achav la'asos la'achis es Hashem Elokei Yisrael mikol malchei Yisrael asher yelofonav. And he increased anger in front of God more than any other of his predecessors. Biyamav bona Chiel beis ha'eli. In his days, Chiel, the man from Beis El, built Es Yericho, the city of Jericho, Ba'aviram b'choro yistah, uzguv tziroi hitzav d'loseha. as he started setting up his foundation, he lost his firstborn, and when he was fixing the doors on the city, he lost his youngest child, Kidvar Hashem Asher Diber Biyad Yoshua Ben Nun, as God spoke at the hand of Yoshua Ben Nun. A lot to think about over here. First of all, his marriage is an important point. That's part of the hara. That's part of the bad that he's doing. He marries this woman by the name of Jezebel. Jezebel is a name which is associated with a lot of complication and evil in life. And let's try to appreciate who she is. She's the daughter of Etbaal, the king of Sidon. Sidon, just to put this thing into perspective, is if you go up the coast of Israel to the north, and you go further up north into where we call today Lebanon, there are two major ports of the ancient world, and they are Tyre, Tsur, and Sidon, right? Those are the two ports. These are very important ports. These are of the Phoenician nation. The Phoenicians were a Canaanite nation, and they had essentially mercantile control of most of the Mediterranean ports. And their centers were Sidon and Tyre. They lived very well and strong until the times of the Greeks. And we hear about the interaction between Israel and the Phoenicians many a time. So, for instance, we know that Shlomo had a great partnership with the king of Tyre. And we know that was part of the actual bridge and the trade for materials necessary to be able to make the Beis HaMikdash. This is sort of a picture of the ancient Sidon of what it looks like today. And of course, it's part of Lebanon today. It's partly modern and partly an archaeological site as well today. Now, why would this king Ahav marry Jezebel? Why would he do this? So the first most basic suggestion is this is a political consideration. If you want to have peace in the north, what you do is you forge a relationship. What better way to forge a relationship than a political marriage? So it sounds like he is in favor of finding peace with the neighbors in the north, which leads into this. It's interesting, the Chida makes a very interesting and short comment, and that is who is Jezebel? Sitra Achra. I know that we throw that word around a lot today, right? We talk about all kinds of people and places as being the Sitra Achra. Sitra Achra literally means the other side. Okay, the on the yonder side, it means the forces of darkness. V'chein Jezebel b'gematria tamei, k'mispar nun shaharei tumah. Right, so she's pretty bad, meaning it sounds like the Chida is saying that she is evil incarnate. Now, just to put that into tangible terms, right? Now, there are many people who say that unfortunately their spouse is the evil incarnate, but that's not, this is different. This is actually, understand the mechanics of this. What was so negative? So the Malbim actually points out, Acharei ha'ion, he says, after a lot of research, Ra'esi ka'avoda sabal ha'isa geru'a yoser mi'inyan ha'asherah. Do you notice that there were two Canaanite gods that were mentioned in these psukim? One is Baal and one is Asherah. Both gods of fertility. Just fertility and rain. Okay? Which makes sense because this is an agrarian society. So what would happen is the people would serve these, you know, deities who are in charge of the different departments that help their farms. Ki ba'avodas ha'baal zivchu es b'nehem ve'hitzivu ma'od. He said, Baal was much worse because, you know what? People would actually sacrifice their children to Baal. In fact, when they did research, when they did archaeological digs near Sidon in the Phoenician port area, they found numerous urns with ashes in them with the words MLK, not to be confused with Martin Luther King, but that actually is also Molech, which is one of the Canaanite pantheon, right, which the Torah already talks about. So infanticide was part of the process of the Baal worship, also Molech as well. Aval ha'asherah ha'yonoitim gam etzal abomo shem ekrivim la'ashem. K'mo shekosov lo sitzach ha'alecho asherah etzal mizbach ha'ashem. We know that the asherah, people would sort of see it as almost like a complementary god, right? They would have a mizbach to Hashem and they'd plant the asherah next to it, which is why the Torah has to go out of his way and say, don't plant the asherah tree, this fertility god, next to the mizbach. It doesn't work like that. In monotheism, it is by definition mono, right? So you can't have any other folks here. But tir'eh, he says, k'iliyahu ha'gam she kibetz nevi'ei ha'bal v'asherah lo hisvakach rak im nevi'ei ha'bal. We'll see that Eliyahu took it much more seriously. In the next perek, when he has the great showdown, he's only going to fight against the prophets of Baal, not the prophets of Asherah. It's much more insidious. It's much more keneged. He says, "V'rak osam harag es nevi'ei eruvelo es nevi'ei Asherah." He didn't kill the prophets of Asherah. V'chein Baal, and he goes on to describe how Baal Yehu as well. He says, why is this? So how could it be that Baal, this Canaanite god, enters so deeply into Israelite society? I mean, this is only five kings in, folks. right? So how could this happen? So the answer is, he says, is because he married somebody who came from that culture. And we saw already Shlomo Melech, when he started fiddling with this, and yes, Shlomo Melech did a conversion. It doesn't seem like Acha did a conversion. He was interested in political conversations. And you know what? It's a melting pot. We're all one big society. We all worship each other's gods. He marries Izebel, and essentially she brings with her the culture of her father. Her father's name was Et Baal. You can understand what the culture was in her house growing up. Right, and she brings that into Israel. This is the lowest Israel has sunk from the time there's been kings. Just appreciate this, what's going on here. So that's what the Malbim points out. In fact, in the version that Josephus has of this, it's just fascinating to complement his description over here. Just listen to this marriage. We hear about the following. Here we are. It says he describes Achav, and we hear about the following. He imitated them in wicked courses and in the injurious behavior toward God, and more especially imitated the transgression of Yerovam, for he worshipped the heifers that he had made and contrived other absurd objects of worship besides those heifers. So besides the Eglei Hazav on the top and the bottom of his kingdom, he also took a wife, the daughter of Eth Baal, king of the Tyrians and Sidonians, whose name was Jezebel, from whom he learned to worship her own gods. This woman was active and bold, and fell into so great a degree of impurity and madness that she built a temple to the gods of the Tyrians, which they called Belus, and planted a grove of all sorts of trees. She also appointed priests and false prophets to this god. The king also himself had many such about him, and so exceeded in madness and wickedness all the kings that went before him. So just giving a little more hue and context as Josephus is adding over here. The words just is adding sort of the you have to understand, as a character, active and bold. She was the one who was the architect for these shrines. You can get a sense of where we're going in society here. This is a very depressing moment in Jewish society. Essentially, all of Israel, which means 10 tribes to the north, are under the control of a woman who is not a Jew. Okay, that's where we are right now in society. I would like to argue at this point in time, and let's see if this argument can hold steady, is that the counterpoint, the antagonist for Eliyahu Navi is not going to be Achav, it's going to be Jezebel, Izebel. And even though they don't have any indirect interactions, it's going to be the fight between the two of them, almost as if Achav is the vehicle between them, but not really the antagonist himself. Let's see if that whole argument holds true. Let's keep learning and see. The last fascinating thing was the rebuilding of Jericho. Fascinating thing, this Chiel, who's building it, his children dying, what is going on over here? A little bit of background again, just a reminder. In the map over here, as you can see, the nation of Israel came into the land of Canaan. They started off over here in Shittim, which is the plains of Moab, the steppes of Moab on the east side of the Jordan. And they crossed the Jordan, camped at Gilgal, and their first conquest was the city of Jericho. And in fact, when Yahushua conquered Jericho, one of the things that was important to him was this was the first conquest in the land of Israel. He felt it needed to be so sacrosanct that he declared that no one could take off any of the spoils. Somebody did, and that was a whole snafu. But what ended up happening was this, he said, he also said something very important. That is, he placed a curse on anybody who'd rebuild it. Just to get a sense of it, I actually prefer this map over here. It gives you a more of a three-dimensional sense of where Israel were. Israel coming in from the right over here as they're trying to cross the Jordan. The Jordan's going to stop at Adam Ha'ir, which is up here. That's where the Jordan River stopped flowing before it reached the Dead Sea. And Jericho, of course, was the first city in encampment. So just gives you a sense between the mountains, the coastal mountains, that's where Jericho was. What's interesting about this is, here's just an air view shot of Jericho. As you can see, it's interesting today. You have the regular sort of modern day settlements and roads and so on. And in the middle, in the center, is all these archaeological digs. They actually say that Jericho is one of the oldest cities of that we have found human civilization for. 10,000 BC, they dated in terms of the dating system. So it's a very, very old and ancient city. A lot of history, lots of layers of history upon it. What is that curse of Yahushua? Yahushua in Perek Vav says, Vayishpa Yahushua ba'es lahi lemor, Arur ha'ish lifnei Hashem ayin sheyakum ubona es la'ir hazois es yirichoi. Cursed be the man who ever rebuilds the city of Jericho, bivchoiroi yisodenu, when he founds it, when he puts the lays the foundations, his firstborn will die, uvetzi'iroi yatziv delaseha, and when he closes those doors, when he finishes those doors, his youngest will die. Well, look at that. Unfortunately, centuries later, we're talking now roughly in the range of probably about, this is almost pushing 500 years later, we're now talking about where Chiel from Beis El goes and rebuilds the city. And in fact, this curse comes upon him. Why? Why is it significant for us to know why is this pasuk being brought over here? So the Radak says, very simple. So he says, you know what? Because it was under his watch. This is a description of the type of leadership that happens. You know, it's kind of, you know, when the police force is told in New York City not to pay attention to small things, then you start seeing the three-card Monty's appearing, right? And you see the window washers, like, you know, things start moving downwards, right? We see what happens. Lahavdil, over here, under Achav's watch is when spiritual calamities start appearing, right? Things start happening. Not good things are about to start happening over here. Okay? That's what we see it's over here. Because it says, Ad Yomav, lo haya Adam she'ala biliboy livnoi sirichoi, mibnei ha-shvua. Up till now, no one would ever imagine of building Jericho. But now it became a reality under the spiritual anarchy that Achav has brought into Israel. The Malbim deepens the blame just a touch more. This is much, much heavier, much darker. Malbim says the following, Ad Ata, till now, Hagam she'avdu agalim, v'lo pakru adayin b'chol shorshei ha'emuna. You know what? Israel were in this complex reality where they were serving God, they were serving conduits to God, these golden calves, which are these oracles, right? We have this whole business. But you know what? They still believed in God to some degree. Now, yes, there was a twisting in the way that they served Him, but they actually believed in God. And therefore they believed in something which was sacrosanct, like building Jericho. But now, look at this. Achav's doing what he wants. He opened up a shrine, Baal, in the middle of Israel. And God is just watching, and everything seems to be just fine. Economy's going up. Unemployment's at its lowest. Everything's just fine. What's the problem over here? They said, you know what? This whole thing about providence, you know, about God being involved, we don't need that anymore. Therefore, they didn't care about the curse of Yeshua. It says the Malbim, a very dark thing is happening here. What is happening is this is a demonstration of the fact that people don't care. People just don't care about God anymore. That's how low we've sunk. And even when his son dies, he's still not noticing. His firstborn dies. You think as a betting person, right? It's just like, you know, the weatherman says there's a 37% chance of rainfall. You replan things. You make a new date. This fellow, he's just going strong. His firstborn dies. Well, unfortunate, right? But this is matching the curse of Yeshua. He's not interested. And this is now the precursor to the entrance of Eliyahu. Just a very, very sad moment in Jewish history. It shows you the tone of society that is set by the leaders of that society, and unfortunately in this case, for the bad. It is interesting, how does this lead us to the next story? So the Al-Sheikh quotes a very famous Gemara in Sanhedrin. Very, very famous Gemara in Sanhedrin, which now is going to set us into the tone, because now we haven't talked about Eliyahu. This is now the entry point of Eliyahu. Well, no odds, says the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh. Ki im gam shira biyustom meis b'chorov v'lona san liboy, kasher niskayma haskolas yiskayma asoy, if they didn't believe that the prophecy about the two children is going to happen. Ki ein ze ki im hispakrus lahachis v'hi ma. This is the most, you know, terrible situation of throwing off the yoke of heaven. V'oz b'gamera davar galoy el achav ma shegoram hispakrus shu hakal v'choymer. If, in fact, the words of the Rav did not come true, what does this mean? So what happened was, is there was a shiva that was being held in Chiel's house for Saguv. And the way he's actually framing it is actually Achav's child. So Eliyahu went to the Shiva house, and he said to Achav, how could it be that the curse of Joshua, of Yeshua, came about, and yet the curse of Moses, his teacher, didn't come about? What did Moshe Rabbeinu says? Oh, we say it every morning. Fantastic. You listen to my mitzvahs. Right, when I'm going to give you everything. It's unbelievable. It's going to be great. But if you don't, then I'm going to stop the rains. Right, that's also part of Moshe Rabbeinu's curse. So if Yeshua's curse came, shouldn't Moshe Rabbeinu's curse come as well? This was actually at the Shiva house. In fact, that leads us to the next pasuk. The next pasuk is Enter Eliyahu. Vayomer Eliyahu atishbi mitoshvei Gilad. Eliyahu comes from Gilad, that's on the east bank of the Jordan. El Achav, Chay Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Asher Amadzi Lefonov, by the life of God who I stand in front of him, Imiya Shanim Ele, Tal Umatar, Ki Im Lefi Devari. He says, you know what? There ain't going to be any rain, except when I say it will be for all these years. He's obviously in this for the long run. Right? So why is this a follow-on? Says the Al-Sheikh, based on the Gemara in Sanhedrin, what he's essentially saying is you just saw the prophecy of Yeshua come to me, I'm going to show you Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy come to me. There is not going to be rain the way you're behaving as well. Just saw a great cartoon in Israel. A cartoon is Eliyahu is here in the weather station. He's about to present, and he says, "Im tavdu et elokim yered geshem, chazara elayich yonit." So Eliyahu is giving the weather report, and he says, "You know, it depends on you. If you want to act nicely, then there'll be good rain." That's, by the way, there's a pretty accurate description of how Hashem likes to operate the world. Unfortunately, sometimes he has to recess himself because we just don't get with the program too well. But this is what Eliyahu essentially is saying. So now, there's a few questions. You know, like, did you notice something? Like, we look at this pasuk, and here we go. Here's Eliyahu. He comes, he's Tishbi. He lives in Gilad. He comes to Achav. I'm sorry? Who is he? Where did he come from? Right, we don't know any context. Now, we don't have context from some other Nevi'im as well. We don't know so much about Nasan and Gad. We don't know so much about some of the other Nevi'im. Achia, Shilani, we aren't told too much about. But it is a bit of an abrupt introduction. It almost sounds like there was a conversation beforehand which happened and we just weren't privy to that. So what is the context to this conversation? For this, we're going to take a look at the works of the Abarbanel. This is a short quotation of a much longer section here of the Abarbanel, where he says, no. This is not the first conversation. He says, "V'yidme she'Eliyahu hoyam edaberim achav hoyam mit masre boi shiyosim eli boi inyan chiel beisag eli." He said, he kept on speaking to him and he said, "Achav, look what's going on. Look at chiel, look what's happening with the children, look what's happening." Right, sh'aval dire Hashem yisparaf v'kuyumu boi haklolos asher ma yosha. And the curses came word for word. V'yo Eliyahu oimer la'achav, yireyas Hashem, pen yechera poi alayich. Yo Alecha, he says, listen to God. God's going to get angry with you, Achav. Also, El Chiel Beis Ha'eli. Look what he did to the family of Chiel. Ulefisha Achav hoya bozed varav Omer Yadosh Hakadosh Baruch Hu lo nagaba mikrehu hoya lechiel. Unfortunate times. Chiel was an unlucky guy, bad sign, bad horoscope. Right, vaya maybe raya minyos kol Yisrael ovdei avodah zarah v'lahaya atziras gushamim k'mo shiira Torah. So Achav says, Chiel's an unlucky guy. You know what? Bad luck, bad year. But me, in the meantime, look at this. I'm doing all this avodah zarah. No problem. Doesn't seem like anything's happened to me. Mibneze heshev Eliyahu el achav v'amalai chay Hashem asher amadzi lefanov im ya hashanim ha'ele tal matar. So the Barbanel says, on similar lines to what the Al-Sheikh was saying, is this was an ongoing conversation. This wasn't as if Eliyahu walked in and stamped his foot. This was now the end of a very, very long dialogue, an end of a relationship of trying to convince him, and clearly Achav was not willing to smell the coffee. Now, we've got a few questions. Is where does Eliyahu come from? So we know his Tishbi. You know what Tishbi is? We do know what he's from Gilad. So which tribe is in Gilad, folks? Who lives in Gilad? Gilad is not the name of a tribe. Gilad is the name of a person. Okay, so Gilad actually comes from
Menashe,
fantastic. Oh, good. So all the folks who are learning Dir Hayamim with me right now, that's where Gilad settles down. He is a grandson, and he settles down in the land of Menashe. Very important. Yavesh Gilad is an important place in general, and so he comes from Transjordan. More than that, we're not given so much context. We don't know so much about him. But there are a few things to clear up. Now, I'm sure there are folks out there who are all thinking, yeah, we know who Eliyahu is. Eliyahu, we know, is a little bit of, but we know a little bit of background. So let's just explore that background. Three possibilities, and let's try to sort of just unpack them slowly through the words of Abarbanel. Why is Abarbanel so helpful? The Abarbanel is just remarkable in every aspect, but what's amazing is he often summarizes the words of those who come before him, usually to reject them. but in certain cases, just to summarize them. So it's very helpful. If you ever want to get a sense of any of the Mepharshim pre-1500, it's very helpful to look at the Abarbanel and get a sense of the expanse. It is very long, but it's very worthwhile. I chose a paragraph over here, which I think is very instructive to being able to understand and give a little bit of context. This paragraph, of course, will require a little more unpacking as we go a little further, because there are more aspects which will corroborate the ideas said here. First, what he does is he says, "Vina Eliyahu lo zachar akos v'shivtoy." We don't know who he is. Aval Omar Bilvad Shoyam Mitoshvei Gilad. He came from Gilad. V'nechluku boy Chazal. So he quotes about Bereshis Rabba. Okay, so this is a central midrash. It says, "Mehem Amru Shoyam Mishavet Binyamin." Some said he came from the tribe of Binyamin. "Mehem Amru Mishivto Shel Gad." Some said he came from Gad, because Gad was also a Transjordan nation as well. Yes, Gilad was kind of a little bit in the territory of Gad, as well as Gilad himself being from Menashe. "V'amru shepam echad hayu chol kimboze v'nire alehem uba v'amad lifneihem v'amar lahem lama atem chol kimolai ani min bnei bnei shel Rachel." So apparently the sages of the Midrash were discussing this, and Eliyahu appeared and he clarified it, and he said he's from bnei Rachel. So in this Midrash essentially says that he comes from Binyamin, and that's the tribe. How do we know? He told us. Okay. By the way, this idea of Eliyahu appearing at various times in history is very important, and is something which we hold dear. We'll come back to the idea, the notion of why it's the Bris Milah and so on later on, as to the appearances that Eliyahu makes in the Jewish life cycle. Okay, we'll see why that's going to be so central. Next. Now, this is the more famous Midrash. This is the Midrash I'm sure all of us are aware of, but it's important to actually take a look at it inside, to appreciate it inside, because we're trying to see this from the ground upwards rather than just the reports. Umehem, he quotes the Yalkut in the beginning of Pinchas. Why Pinchas? Amru Sheliyahu Pinchas. Really, Eliyahu is Pinchas. Now, you say, that's a very long period of time, right? Think about it, right? Just remember, we talk about plus 500 years, right? So how does that work exactly? So if you, first to answer that question, and then a few proofs that this could be the case. Number one, Vihine. We know that Pinchas was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, that doesn't mean to say he got a nice medallion and he hung it up on the wall. What does that mean? What does shalom mean? It means peace from death. That means to say that he was granted peace, that he would not die. What does my covenant mean? Two things, chayim and shalom. So what was he afforded? Long life. At the way end of Shoftim, if we assume that Shoftim is in chronological order, which many of the Mepharshim do, at the end of 369 years from entry into the land of Israel, Pinchas appears as Pinchas. He's right there, right? So that means to say that he's still around. If you've been David, Motzana Kosov, Bedira Yamim, Upinchas ben Elazar, Negid Hoyo Alehem, Lifnim, Vashem Imoy. By the way, just as an interesting aside, that was Nachyomi today. Okay, nonetheless, so in Perek Tes and Dira Yamim Aleph, we see that Pinchas is already recorded the times of David HaMelech. That's also pretty far in. So he says, you see, Ad Shiyesh Mi Shechoshav Shehu Hoyo Malach, Shinire El Gidon Vel Yiftach. We know that there was an anonymous angel or messenger who appeared to the Shoftim, Gidon and Yiftach. So some attribute that was Pinchas as well. And he had the same spirit as Eliyahu did. V'ulai, shelaze omar Eliyahu bezois haparsha, rav ato. Later on, when he requests to die from Hashem because he's not better than his forefathers, what is he saying? I want to die like my fathers. What he means to say is, I've lived too long. I've seen too much pain. It's too difficult. Bnei Yisrael, stubborn people, right? It's just too much, right? So what he was essentially saying was, right, Lahavdil, Green Mile, it's too much. I can't deal. I can't have longevity right now. It's not helping. Umatzanu od, and he says, Shaloi meis ba'is asher lokech ma'al rosh Elisha. You know, even when he dies, he doesn't die, right? How does Eliyahu end? I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but he goes up in a chariot to heaven, which means that he doesn't even die then, right? So not only does he not, so to speak, have a starting point, he doesn't have an ending point, says Abba Harbinel. Right? V'ze ki acharei kein yomim rabim ba michtav me'eliyahu el Yehoram ben Yehoshaphat. 2 generations later, Yehoram is going to receive a letter from Eliyahu, michtav me'eliyahu. He says, "Kamosh nizka b'divrei yamim," as divrei yamim is going to record. Ve'ein lanu shenomar ki kozav Eliyahu kodim shelokeh. You can't say that Eliyahu penned it and kind of like, you know, put it in the snail mail and hope that it arrived 2 generations later. That's not happening. He says, why? He didn't know that that was going to be the situation in 2 generations' time, and even if he knew by prophecy, he was hoping they were going to change, right? The grandson is going to act in a really bad way, worse than his forefathers, and kill his brother. I mean, how can you know that kind of stuff, right? So how can you write that? He gives this terrible punishment to Yoram. Who's writing this? Right? Eliyahu's going to write that. Give it to somebody who knows he's going to be around for 2 generations. Do you know anybody who's going to be around for 2 generations? You can guarantee he's going to give the letter. Right? It doesn't make sense unless you said he didn't die. So therefore, the Abarbanel says, there seems to be something, and the Abarbanel comes to the rational camp, right? He's not generally into the Kabbalistic things, but he's saying, this Midrash does make a lot of sense. After all, we see sometime Hashem somehow involved himself in the life of Pinchas, and said, Pinchas, you're going to have a very long life. Okay? And in fact, we see that his life doesn't end. It must be, says the Abarbanel, that it could be that this in fact is Pinchas. This explains why we have no context for who Eliyahu is, because maybe it's just a continuation. A few points, just like a few asterisks to Zababrinel. Number one is, if he's Pinchas, then why is he not called Pinchas? Question for homework. Why would that be, if he really is the same person? Could it be that he's perhaps the same soul, in a different form, in a different life? Possible. I mean, is it more allegorical? Is it more literal? Question. Another thing to we're thinking about is that actually Pinchas himself actually had a little bit of a spiritual decline. And that is that we see that at the end, Pinchas was not seen as this in the same way as he was initially. Certainly not in the days of Parshas, Balak, and Pinchas. And the reason being is, the Midrash identifies, is that he was around during the period of Shoftim, and he was somewhat absent. Yes, it may have been the Malach appeared to Gidon and to Yiftach, but there was a number of occasions where he really should have appeared and he didn't appear. One classic example is the fact that Yiftach makes a terrible, terrible mistake. When he goes out to battle, he makes a neder that if he wins this battle, whatever comes out of his gate first is going to be a sacrifice to God, and lo and behold, his own daughter comes running out the gate to greet him. And there's this terrible, terrible description of how he has to battle for himself, and finally he banishes her, whether he kills her or banishes her to a celibate life all alone, and she dies all alone. It's a terrible, terrible situation, whichever way you want to cut it. And the Midrash asks the basic question, is like, where were the leaders? I mean, like, Yiftach is the Shofet of Israel, so he couldn't find anybody who couldn't find any spiritual leader. Where was Pinchas, the Midrash asks? And the Midrash says, Pinchas says, I'm the Kohen Gadol. Yiftach, the general, he wants to ask Gishalak, come to my chambers. Yiftach says, I'm the general. I should go to speak to the spiritual oracle. He should come to me. And the Midrash concludes, this is between the two arrogances, the girl was lost. Which means to say that there was fault in Yiftach and there's fault in Pinchas, and Pinchas lost his spiritual stature as a Navi at that point in time because of his, so to speak, self-perception of gravitas, which means to say that there was something lost in Pinchas, and one wonders if this may be another iteration or perhaps a rejuvenation of that Pinchas in the Eliyahu form. Just worthwhile thinking about. We will also now, with this format in the background, we will try to notice more commonalities, more similarities between Pinchas and Eliyahu. We'll see it in language and in attitude towards the nation of Israel as we go further. That's what the Abarbanel says over here. By the way, there's a Chidah who deepens this theme as well about him being the Eliyahu. We'll focus on that a little bit later on. Some interesting gematrias. Okay, now let's try to close today with what happens. So now, at this point in time, Eliyahu has made a declaration, and we have to ask ourselves, so did that happen? The answer is, it sure did. That's the next week's talking over here. Vayhi dvar Hashem elav lemor, lech mizeh uponisa lecha kedma, go eastwards, v'nistarta b'nachal Chris. You should hide in the Chris Brook. Asher al Pnei HaYarden, which is just off of the Jordan River, which is on the east bank of Israel. Vayob mi'anachal tishteh ve'ezo arvim tzivisi lechalke lecha sham. I will allow you to drink from the river, and the ravens will feed you there. Vayelech vayas kidvar Hashem vayelech vayeshev banachal kris asher al Pnei HaYarden. He goes and dwells there. For arvim mevim lo lechem ubasar ba'boike ve'lechem ubasar ba'erev mi'anachal yishteh. So what we say, Uber Eats, right? He's got everything he needs. The food comes in, morning and evening, and he has the river to drink from. And after a while, whether it be a year or so, there's no rain, there's no river. So therefore, it drains up. That's going to be our next exciting episode, is when we're trying to understand what's really going on over here. So what's going on over here? Why is he being sent away? Meaning, if he's right, if Eliyahu is 100% correct, then Hashem should have said, Yasha Koyach. I was waiting for Bnei Yisrael to get punished. They were no good. So why is he being sent away? Maybe he's being sent away for safety. What's going on here? Says the Malbim. Leich mizet, zivol yisrachek misham ibn mei ha-slakonam, ibn mei she'achar shu otzares ha-shefa mi-osom v'sosares ha-tzin nor rois ha-elyonim. Me'arik alei mayim. It could be because of his own slakonam, because he's just upset the king. And the people are going to be very upset that he's the only one who holds the keys. Or it could be because he's the one who just diverted the spiritual channels of energy in the world. So what's going to happen? Let's say Eliyahu, who's very much attached to the divine, is now going to have his own dispenser, right? So he's going to have rain, he's going to have water. Well, that's not going to be very helpful for his curse, because if he's just cursed the people and he has his own little oasis, so that's going to spread further, right? The rivers, the rain's going to spread out, and the canals will go, and people will be able to benefit. So Hashem says, to fully fulfill your curse, this is actually now augmenting his curse, which is go away, go to a place where it's devastated, there's nobody there, so therefore I can feed you in a way that will not have collateral benefit to the rest of the people around you, says the things. And that's why he left. So the Malbim sees this either for his own safety or for the augmentation of his curse being more prolific. That's the way he's looking at it over here. This means to say, if you're to ask the Malbim at this point in time, does Hashem agree with the decree that essentially Eliyahu places upon Israel? The answer is yes. Just a precautionary measure. You should probably not be your persona non grata. Please maybe make sure that you're not here, or let's make sure I'll take care of you somewhere else. Now, Baba Nel is a little bit different here. He says, "Lufish Eliyahu asa ze belit zivoy elokim beli rushus ki mirtzono v'chir asa lekanoes kinas Hashem." Think about this for a second. Why was Eliyahu doing this? Eliyahu felt that God had been affronted. He thinks that, look at this. Hashem is being treated like this. Everybody's laughing and scoffing. They don't even take notice when they build the Yericho, the curse comes to be. This is shocking. This is a shanda, right? So he now says, I'm going to fight for God. Kanoi kinesi. By the way, that's an important word. It's the word kina, because that relates to Pinchas again. Ulachain, ba'uhu, hadibur haze, leich mizeu ponisa keid mavagomer, rotzelomar, why did Hashem tell him to go? Acharesh ashisa zeroi shetilishtadel, lakayamoi. You need to now try to fulfill it. Vieze keshetechove, makom nistar, shloyim sa'ucha an sheyacha, ulachain, shalchu, rishona, leoiso nachal chris, yosho shomotmima, ad shivasan nachal. Right? So he says, you need to find refuge in all of this really be fulfilled. You need to control this, because if you're in control and you're over there, they might force you to perhaps abrogate this. Now, to me, there's something really fascinating. I remember a number of years ago I was in Chicago, and Rabbi Foreman actually came out, and he was having a whole discussion actually in Parashas Vayetze, and he made a number of very, very fascinating observations. But one thing which is really fascinating to observe over here is this whole business of the ravens. The ravens are a very fascinating thing. First time the raven appears in Tanakh, actually, explicitly, is actually in Parashas Noach. Remember, if you remember this over here, that there was a the Rashi actually quotes over here by Bereshis, Ad Yeveshes Hamayim Pshutoy Kamashmoi Aval Midrash Agada Muchan Hoyah Arev Lishlichus Acheres Ba'atziras Kishamim B'mei Eliyahu. Why was it that the raven that Noach sent out from the Teva returned back to the Teva? It wasn't like the dove which came back with the olive branch. Why couldn't the raven just do its bidding after all? Says Rashi, because it was waiting to do the bidding of Eliyahu, as quoting our pasuk, "Va'arvim mivin lo lechem ubasar." Think about that for a second. That means to say that there's a certain like sort of divine decree which is going on in those days, and a divine decree which is going on in these days, and there's some sort of connection over here. There it was humanity not living up to their bill, and then the world getting destroyed with water. Here we have humanity or Israel on a more microcosmic level not living up to their bidding. And they're being destroyed through the lack of water. And in the one case, the Orev was supposed to be the agent. In the other case, the Orev is the agent. There's something that Rashi is trying to get to us over here as well. If we think about it a little more in a deeper fashion, the word Orev itself actually has another meaning. Orev means a raven, but Orev also means Arav is also means the word guarantor. And an Orev is a guarantor. So let's say that you take a debt. So you get an Orev for you who will be responsible for that debt were you not to pay it up. So in a certain sense, thinking about this over here, the notion of responsibility. Why would God be sending him a message couched in the notion of responsibility? Why would he be sending him an agent which was used in the biblical past as a famous example of, so to speak, the end of the flood incident? Let's go a little further. Where was this Nachal Kris, Karas, sort of like the notion of almost like a covenant of sort, like the play on the words bris and Karas bris, of covenant. There's the idea of responsibility, a covenant, this brook over here. What's really going on over here? In a certain sense, it's almost as if Eliyahu is supposed to be being reminded that as bad as humanity was, God decided that, you know what, even though they were truly deserving of destruction, Hashem still retracted that and welcomed them back in, even though they were not worthy. In a certain sense, it's almost as if you wonder if this whole process itself is a process of, rehabilitation on the one hand of Israel and rehabilitation of Eliyahu on his side. If you think about that from that perspective, Israel's rehabilitation is much more obvious. They need to spiritually be put into line. But Eliyahu also needs rehabilitation. Why does he need rehabilitation? Because what's happening is he thinks that if people are not acting the way they should, they deserve immediate punishment. They need to be put in the timeout corner. And Hashem is saying, it's not that simple. I tried this once, didn't work so well. We had to start again, and I said I wasn't going to do this again to them. Be careful. And in fact, Rav Yigal Ariel, will close with these words, just says a very beautiful, very poetic idea over here. He says the following: Ha'iruim ha'mofiim b'perek ba'im b'adraga v'haslama. There's a certain gradation of the events that occur in our perek. B'tchila bodadois Eliyahu v'sipu koila b'asaru mayim. At the beginning, he starts off, he has meat, he has water. Mitoch tikva sheyis yisorer me'atzmoy lesolida Dariot im Yisrael, to cultivate him a certain level of solidarity with Israel, meaning to say the diet that he's receiving over here is less than perfect. This is not Uber Eats. This is not what is good enough for him. So what Hashem is trying to do is to say, hey, yo, you need to sense what people are going through. Mishelo ila davar v'nishar adish yav shua mayim. So what does Hashem do? Hashem retracts the water as well. We're going to see next week as he comes to the widow's house. He's going to see what his shavua of stopping the rains has caused, the collateral damage caused in society. And he does see the suffering of the righteous, but he doesn't get it. He's going to solve the problem of this widow. He's going to solve an immediate, specific problem in front of him, but he's not going to reflect on it as it relates to the whole klal. As you're going to see, he's going to try to save the son of this almana, and in that moment of pity, in that moment of mercy, a little bit of the shell is cracked, and Eliyahu is able to beg for mercy on the people. These words of the Migdash Melech, and the Mepharshim talk about this in different ways, is going to be one of the crucial points that's going to happen. You see, we're going to have to look at this, at everything we're learning now, from a few different perspectives. We're going to have to look at it from the protagonist-antagonist perspective. Izebel's plan and Eliyahu's plan, and the middle man, which is going to be Ahav. So we're going to have to witness that dimension of it, which is going to be a spiritual, you know, showdown of magnificent proportions. That's one aspect of reading the stories of Eliyahu. And I would say that's the more simplistic way of looking at it. There's another plane of looking, and that's not the horizontal plane, but it's sort of the vertical plane. It's the relationship of Eliyahu and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and in this case, the middle person is Klal Yisrael. And the question is the following: is how severe a punishment are human beings deserving when they act out? This is for any parent, any grandparent, any person who goes through the idea of dealing with other people and the complexity of the humankind. They just keep messing up. Every single time you tell them don't do it, they do it three times. It just doesn't work out. And any person in communal leadership, social leadership, sees this all the time. And the struggle a person has, this is what Eliyahu is struggling with, is how Yikov Adin HaZahar, how just does a person need to be? How much mercy? And this is the struggle that's going to happen. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying, yes, they do deserve it, but perhaps you're being too cruel. That's the struggle we're going to see over here. How much is it important to be a mekaneh, to be a zealot? Because zealotry has a cost. That's what's going to be happening here. It's almost as if this is the exploration of the notion of zealotry itself. This is the opening of this very, very fascinating parsha of Eliyahu. And of course, it opens not with fire, but with water, as he marshals and he brings, so to speak, Hashem's control into this world at his own beck and call. Okay, we stop over here.